Hey everybody, this is Michael Collins. This is Lunchtime Learning for February 18th. We're going to talk today about medical debt and paying medical bills. I'm going to start just briefly and remind people about what the Lunchtime Learning series is about and also some of the resources that are available. So Lunchtime Learning takes place at noon on the third Mondays of the month and take about an hour total. Usually I talk for 30, 35 minutes, and then we leave the rest of the time for your comments and questions. And the topics for these calls were suggested by colleagues over the last year or so. So we are sort of ticking through the suggestions that were made last summer. And we have a number of topics coming up over the next few months that I'll talk about towards the end of this call. But for each call, there is a brief, we call them. So these are short, 4, 5, 6 page, sort of two-column briefs that are placed on the website, fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series. And so this is set up sort of like a blog. So if you just go to that website, the very first item will be the most recent brief. And so the current one is called Medical Debt and Financial Security. And if you click that link, it'll bring up a Adobe Acrobat or a PDF document. And that's what I'm going to talk about today primarily is that Adobe Acrobat PDF document. In that document are a number of links, and so I will talk about some of those links. There must be 24 links in today, so I won't talk about every single one of those. So I'd encourage you to pull up the PDF and spend some time fishing around some of those links if this is a topic that you're interested in. At the end of the brief are a number of additional resources, so websites that are relevant for this topic, which also are sort of for further reading. I will say that, you know, in terms of the scope of different topics that we've taken on in the Lunchtime Learning series, this is a big one, a tough one, and one that really pushes the boundaries of any expertise that I have. It involves issues with the health system. It involves issues with the law, creditors. It is a very, very complicated topic to try to tackle. So I'd encourage you to think about the brief today as really being version 1.0. We've asked some legal folks here at UW at the law school to review some items in here. We've asked the national experts on medical debt and paying for medical expenses to give us some feedback. So we'll probably revise this particular brief over time, just because it's a changing topic, a moving topic, and also one that is incredibly technical and complex. So I'll do my best to try to get the big picture across to folks today. Many of you may have far more experience than me in actually dealing with these issues, either personally or with clients. And so I encourage you at the end to share any advice or resources that you can with the group as well. So before I get going, any questions about the overall series or today's topic? Okay, great. And this is a recorded line, so we will have today's discussion put on a MP3 file that will be uploaded to the fyi.uwex.edu/financial-series website. So along with the brief, later on you can come to the site and hear this, a particular conversation or any of the Lunchtime Learning series that we've had over the last 2.5 years, which are all archived as MP3 files on the website as well. All right, so I'm going to talk essentially in the same order that the brief goes through topics, starting with a description of what this issue is of medical debt or of medical expenses and how it affects family economics, how it affects the bottom line of households in terms of their balance sheets, in terms of their income and expenses. And oftentimes when we talk about medical debt, I think the bias is to say, well, that's an issue for people who don't have health insurance. And certainly it's true that there are a lot of people, especially young people, without health insurance. And you don't have health insurance, if you start to use health care services, you end up paying those bills out of pocket, and that gets expensive. So I'm not in any way saying that the uninsured don't have to face these kinds of problems. But I think it's important to remember that medical debt and unpaid medical expenses are somewhat universal. People who have private health insurance, public health insurance, people who have a coverage through their employer who are involved in the private market as individual purchasers of health insurance, they all face these issues. Health insurance, even the best private health insurance, doesn't cover everything. And in the case of an emergency, in the case of an expensive procedure, in the case of a chronic illness, those expenses can really add up. And the issues are certainly more serious if you don't have health insurance, I mean, particularly because the uninsured don't get the care at all. But when they do get the care, they have to pay for it out of pocket. But it's also true that there's out-of-pocket expenses that everyone faces. Even people who have really good health insurance or people who are on Medicare still have to face out-of-pocket expenses. And those bills can add up. So there's some data in here from the National Health Interview Survey, which is a nationally representative survey of people and households that are facing a number of different issues in the healthcare market, including health outcomes and a bunch of other data points that they collect. But one of the questions they ask about, a series of questions they ask about, is the financial burden of paying for medical bills. And about 1 in 5 of the people in that survey said that they had problems paying medical bills in the last 12 months. And about 1 in 3 reported any burden of healthcare, financial burden of healthcare. And obviously, if you look at some of the more detailed breakdowns, and there's a link in the PDF you can go to see more more focused breakdowns by age or by income bracket. The share of people who have problems paying medical bills or who face a financial burden from medical care, health care, get higher and higher as you go down the income spectrum, and if you look at particularly children and some elderly groups. So the bottom line is that this is an issue that's out there. It's an issue that has continued to be out there. And even with health care reform, these issues will remain. Under health care reform, there are still going to be some expenses that are not fully reimbursed. There are still going to be people who are not fully covered or who are not covered at all. And these costs are going to continue to be out there. When people owe medical debt, there's a couple of things that can happen. One is they can just struggle to make ends meet and continue to pay all their bills, and you know they have to give some things up, but they continue to pay their bills. In some cases, they can't keep up with their bills, and then their bills essentially roll over and become debt. They become something that is a judgment against them or something that goes into their credit reporting collection. And so we're going to talk a lot about medical debt as if it's a loan that we're, you know, somehow somebody decided they were going to get an operation, so they went to the bank and they took out a loan and they took out the loan and then they got the operation. Not the way it typically works in this market. Instead, you get the health care that you need, and then the bills start coming and you can't keep up, and as you can't keep up, those liabilities we start to refer to as quote-unquote debt. But essentially they're unpaid bills, and those unpaid bills then become something that goes to collections and gets treated much like a debt would be. It's a liability that's on the credit report. Now, there are cases we'll talk about at the end where it's truly medical debt, where people did borrow in order to take on health care. But you know, generally, we're just talking about an expense that wasn't paid. And so this is unlike really a lot of other markets that we can think of. It's, you know, I guess the closest would be thinking about tax, quote-unquote tax debt, where somebody owes back taxes and has to figure out a way to pay those kinds of bills. So I think that's an important piece of language to keep in mind as we think about this. All right, so before I talk about dealing with medical bills, how do you deal with unpaid medical bills or high medical care costs, I just want to talk a little bit about how to prevent these issues from happening in the first place. So we'll talk a little prevention first before we talk about what to do once the problem starts. And, I mean, really we could do a whole brief just on how to financially manage getting health care. But I think, you know, for when you have clients who are perhaps in a general financial education class or thinking about how to manage an upcoming set of healthcare expenses, thinking about how to prevent problems is important. So why don't we start with that? So obviously, if you don't have medical care coverage, having health insurance to help pay those bills is probably the most important step you can take. I think the number one here is to get covered. Getting coverage from an employer is usually pretty straightforward. It's oftentimes not the best coverage. Sometimes it's not available at all. We're going to start to see more options for non-employer-based healthcare. So people who are outside of the pooled insurance environment are going to have more options available. But for many people in Wisconsin, particularly if they're lower income, finding health insurance through the state of Wisconsin is probably one of the best places to start. So in Wisconsin, we have the Access website, which is a screening tool many of you are familiar with. It's for screening for public benefits of all kinds, food support, other kinds of housing or energy assistance, those kinds of things. But particularly, it can be useful to figuring out if you might qualify for Badger Care, for subsidized the Medicaid program in Wisconsin. There's a similar website that the federal government maintains called healthcare.gov, where you can learn about private and community-based insurance programs. We'll start to see, it's sort of hard to see how this is going to play out right now, but we'll start to see more options in the future for private market, non-employer-based markets outside of the Medicaid market. There is a nice website that the Department of Health Services in Wisconsin maintains, and that's, I think, item 1C on page 2, that you can look at to look at different options for health insurance, especially for some special populations. There is a program that many of you are familiar with that has a connection to Extension called Covering Kids and Families, which works through the school system to help find students who are eligible for school children who are eligible for Medicaid and try to get them engaged in Badger Care through the school system. So that's one way that families are engaged in the system is through that particular initiative, Covering Kids and Families. And they have a great website and resources that you're probably, many of you are already familiar with. So that's number one, is that try to get coverage before racking up medical costs or medical expenses. Number two is once you have coverage, really using your coverage well. And we see this a lot where people find a provider, they get care, and then they try to figure out if their insurance company will cover that provider or not. We've probably all experienced this. And that's probably the wrong order to go in. I think the key thing for all of us and for anybody you work with is to check first. And even if you have Badger Care, even if you have a program that seems like it's well-defined, to check whether this particular procedure or this particular provider actually is covered under the plan. Sometimes plans do cover an expense, but they're on a reimbursement basis, or there's a high copay, or a coinsurance, or a deductible, those kinds of things. And those can be costly, and understanding that before you go into the office is an important thing. And it's also important to note that many times if you go to the medical care provider and ask them these questions, they don't know. They deal with so many different plans and programs, specifically what your plan will provide that provider can be unknown. So it's really on you to do a little work before you get to the doctor's office or to the healthcare provider's office. The next thing to think about is nobody does this, and it's one of these things that economists always say, well, people should be more price conscious when they're seeking healthcare. So, I can probably name count with one hand the number of people who actually do shop around when it comes time for their annual mammogram or for some procedure that they need to pay for. But Wisconsin actually has a pretty nice system called PricePoint. So it's a website where you can look at what some of the bigger hospitals and healthcare facilities charge for some common procedures. So you actually can shop around. And if you do have to pay out of pocket or if you face a high copay or coinsurance, it might be a case where you want to try to find the lowest possible price for a particular procedure. And so looking around, if there are three or four providers near you, you might try to find which of those actually has the lowest price to get something done. So the kinds of features that people will oftentimes shop around for would be more major diagnostics or perhaps procedures that are fairly common and listed in the system. You know, I think the other thing is the number one way to rack up a big medical bill that most insurers are not keen on paying most of the price of is to go to the ER. And I know parents, I'm a parent, I've done this, I've been to the ER multiple times, you know, and I've done it for myself, and, you know, when an emergency comes, your sort of instinct is to go to the ER, and oftentimes when you get to the ER, you realize it really wasn't such an emergency because you're going to sit for 2 hours anyway, and you could have gone to the urgent care place at the, you know, down the street at the community center, at Walgreens even sometimes. So, you know, trying to really be thoughtful in a panicked moment where you see blood or where you think there's some life-threatening emergency is hard. Is this really life-threatening? Do we really need to go to the ER? Or can we go to a less intensive, sort of tertiary care center? And it's a hard thing to evaluate in the heat of the moment, but oftentimes the emergency room is the source of high costs that end up coming out of your pocket or out of the client's pocket as they think about, how they got these costs on their medical bills. Another thing to think about, particularly if you work with clients who are in, who have lower incomes and who might qualify for clinic care, or if you're in communities that has a clinic available, perhaps income-based and perhaps not income-based, it would be to find a health center. And sometimes community health centers, while they don't offer every service, and you know, oftentimes there can be waits for services, they do have the ability to get people low-cost care and sometimes free care, especially preventative care. So finding community resources from health services or health centers is important. There is a link on the Wisconsin Department of Health website for information about health centers that are available. And there's a significant portion of funding in the Healthcare Reform Act from a couple of years ago, which is designed to go towards community center-based healthcare, particularly preventative care. So we might see some growth in that area. I know it's very spotty if we look at some of the more rural parts of the state in terms of access to clinics and hours, and you know, the clinic system is somewhat spotty. But when it does exist, it can be an alternative to help get care at a reduced cost and sometimes no cost. Another way to prevent racking up bills and the costs associated with healthcare can be to focus on the prescription drug costs. And with the advent of the Part D and Medicare, we don't hear as much about ongoing prescription drug costs for the elderly, which is sort of the senior market is a big market for the pharmaceutical company. But there are lots of people who are not covered under Medicare who do have chronic conditions where they have to take ongoing expensive drugs, and their insurance doesn't cover all the costs. And there are programs available, and the Wisconsin, again, the Department of Health has some information about prescription drug assistance programs. There are different kinds of prescription drug assistance programs. Some are available directly from the pharmaceutical company, so a company like Merck or Pfizer might actually offer a special program for reduced or free access to some of its drugs. There are also subsidy programs and charity programs, which are available for not very many people. I mean, this is not a widespread benefit that a lot of people can tap into, but it still provides some access for those who are qualified to get lower-cost prescription drugs. Finally, there's a whole category of chronic health issues or illnesses that might qualify under disability. So there are the issue with eligibility for disability for is complicated. So there's private disability insurance, there's workers' compensation, there's Social Security disability insurance, there's Social Security supplemental income related to disability. So it gets very complicated in terms of who might qualify. But particularly when you're talking about a child with a chronic illness, somebody who has cancer or a debilitating disease where they were able to work and no longer able to work, disability programs or disability insurance might be an important way to get income support. But notably, qualification for SSDI and SSI can actually trigger eligibility for Medicare and or Medicaid as well. So it oftentimes requires some period of time of being in the program before you qualify, but it can trigger access to health insurance as well. So this is a very complicated topic. I'm not doing it justice with one paragraph in the brief or, you know, 2 minutes of discussion here. But for people who really have a chronic illness and are not able to work, or they have to care for a child with a chronic illness, the disability programs and the related insurance, health insurance that can come with being on a disability program are worthy of exploring. Okay, so I'm going to shift gears now from describing the problem and talking about ways to prevent taking on medical costs to talking about what happens once you've already incurred it. And this is probably as a financial coach or counselor or educator, this is probably the situation you find yourself in most often. Somebody comes to you and says, I have $50,000 worth of medical debt. What do I do? And I get this question fairly regularly, and it's very hard to have a concrete answer to this problem. And it's not everybody that has significant medical debt, but when people have medical debt in their credit report, you'll notice it because it can be really big. We've done some research with low-income people and working with them on their credit reports and finding, you know, typically the amount of debt that people have might be $25,000, $30,000, but occasionally you find people with $100,000 of a debt. And it's not student loans, it's not mortgages, it's almost always medical debt when it's that big. And it's very hard to think about how you would, you know, if you're making $15,000 or $20,000 a year, ever be able to catch up on that size of a debt and kind of get around that is very hard. Now, in some ways, medical debt is just like all other debt. You know, it is a obligation that you have to pay. If you don't pay it, you end up paying more. And at some point, collectors start to come after you. It's in your credit report. There'll be judgments. There'll be legal processes where they try to find that debt. And at some point in time, the sort of debt reaches the statute of limitations and it is sort of written off. But like all debt, this can be an ugly process. It can be an unpredictable process. It can involve working with courts and attorneys and get pretty expensive. So I'm not going to talk generally about how to manage collections or debt. I think we have talked about collections and financial counseling in the past. And so all those rules still apply, really, and when you're thinking about medical debt and how to create repayment plans and those kinds of things. I think when you're talking about medical debt, there's some unique aspects to it that we might want to focus a little bit on. But before I talk about that, let me also mention, if you find somebody who's at the point where they're struggling to pay their bills because of medical debt, a key thing is to not get in a situation where you're behind on your medical debt and everything else. I mean, to the extent you can compartmentalize your trouble into the medical debt and not also get behind on your mortgage or get behind on your rent or get behind on your car payments or get behind on your credit card bills or your heating bills, that's the situation where people pay a little bit of all their bills and end up getting behind on everything is far worse than when people can sort of say, okay, I can't pay the medical bills, and I'm going to focus on coming up with a plan for that, but I'm going to continue to pay everything else because I can't afford to pay everything else if I don't pay the medical bills. And so I think that's a key thing to work on with people, is really having a strategy so they're not, you know, ending up having collectors coming at them not just for their medical debt but for everything else too, which is a double whammy of getting engaged in medical expenses and high medical costs. All right, so first, for people who have mounting medical bills and aren't yet in debt, in other words, it hasn't gone to collections, it hasn't sort of hit their credit report, is to see why it is you're being charged that particular item. Sometimes you get charged, and we've probably gone all through this, where insurance company gets a claim, a bill from a particular provider. They look at it, something's not quite right, so they reject it. And then they send the bill to you as the patient and say, well, it's your fault now, you have to pay for this. And the truth is that the claim just probably needed to be reprocessed, probably one little code, one number was off by a digit, something like that, and it goes back to when it gets paid. And when you have health coverage, you have to really understand the bills and the coverage. And when you see something that doesn't go through, when there's an expense that comes back to you, don't just pay it. The first step is to make sure you understand why it was rejected and why it is that you're on the, your responsibility, why you're on the hook for paying that now, and how do you try to remedy that? How do you try to work with the health insurance provider or the healthcare provider to make sure that you do get it covered if it can be covered? There's something called an explanation of benefits, or EOB, that the healthcare provider will get from the insurance company. Typically, you as the insured would get a copy of this as well, but it's not always the case, particularly as we look at more and more electronic transfer of forms and whatnot. You may not see the explanation of benefits. The explanation of benefits should say what the insurance company pays, what the patient pays, and then what's not covered, but and essentially that the healthcare provider has to just write off. They're not going to get paid. They can't get it from the patient, and they can't get it from the insurance company. And there's oftentimes several iterations of these where a claim is submitted, it's rejected, it's partially paid, it's, you know, and so it goes round and round in a sort of very cyclical process. I think the one thing to keep in mind is that it's not unusual to spend, you know, literally hours on the phone with healthcare providers and with insurance companies to try to understand what happened with an EOB. So one thing to prepare clients for in education or in counseling is if you're going to dispute this, if you're going to try to figure out a way to get the health insurance company to actually cover this, you're going to have to do some work, and it's going to require some focused time, unfortunately, on the phone, much of it on hold, getting handed off from you know, one agent to another and trying to re-explain what's going on. So keeping careful documentation of phone calls, who you talk to, what date, what time, and really being persistent and patient, being really patient about dealing with these companies and trying to get as much covered as you possibly can. You know, management is a big part of this. Having a system to keep this mountain of paper. If you're really, if you spend a few days in the hospital and have some follow-up visits, you're going to get probably 20 or 30 statements from different providers. And keeping track of all this, keeping it in an organized way, having a folder, really trying to be diligent about keeping up with this stuff. Now, the difficulty is that you're either doing this for somebody else when there's a sick person in your house, or you yourself are sick. And so you can see why a lot of people get behind, and they don't pay good attention, close attention to the explanation of benefits. And then it just, instead of looking through 30 pages, now they have to go through 90 pages. And it just becomes overwhelming to try to understand what they need to fight and what they need to actually just pay. There is a nice link in the brief to the American Academy of Family Physicians where they offer some guidance on how to read a medical bill and how to read an explanation of benefits and decipher some of these codes. It's not a form of communication, anything like English. It's a bunch of codes and abbreviations, and so they have sort of a translation guide to help help get through that. One important thing that you can work with clients to do when they're not getting satisfaction from calling and waiting on the phone and trying to manage their paperwork is to complain. And so the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection has a hotline they can call. The Office of Commissioners of Insurance has a hotline that they can call. And there's a couple of links in the brief, including a blog post in the New York Times and some information from the Department of Health on how to deal with problems with health insurance companies and with denials. So your first step is to get on the phone, try to get some satisfaction. If you can't get satisfaction and you feel like they're just not listening, they're not doing what they promised to do, they're not sort of following the rules, then you complain. And you complain at the, really to the state regulators to say that these insurance companies aren't fulfilling what they ought to be doing in terms of serving consumers. So that's dealing with getting things paid by insurers when you have that option available. The next thing is you've exhausted your insurance coverage and you now realize that you are on the hook. You have to make these payments yourself out of pocket. There's no other coverage that's going to be available. What do you do? And most healthcare providers, hospitals, and others are not in the business of debt collection. And so when a particular bill goes to being, say, 30 days delinquent, 60 days delinquent, 90 days delinquent, at some point they're going to start to levy fees so that the bill gets bigger. And then at some point they're going to say, you know what, we are not in the business of doing collections. We're going to sell this particular debt, or we're going to pay somebody else to service this debt for us. And so they hand it off to a collections agency. The collections agency may be a specialist in medical debt. They may just be a generic collections agency. They may be collecting on credit cards and car loans and, you know, anything else that's out there. So they're just going to work this like they do everything else. They have a call center. They have access to online credit reports. They try to figure out where you are. They try to figure out how much you can pay, and they try to get as much as you can, they can from you. But there are many, many rules about debt collection and how often collectors can contact you and what constitutes harassment when they're allowed to call. Again, these are topics we've talked about in the past, but once a medical debt goes to a collector, it's really sort of out of the medical system now into the general debt collection service. It is important, though, that particularly hospitals, and to some extent larger healthcare providers, they do care about their reputation. And so, you know, they really don't want you to have this medical debt going to collectors that potentially could end up in the newspapers. You know, you end up getting thrown out of your house to pay their bills. And so they do try to come up with ways to provide alternatives to sending you to collection. And these can be payment plans, be one title they might give to them, or they might have other kinds of processes in place to try to figure out a way that you can pay at least some portion of your bills over time without having to hit your credit report, without having it go to collection. Many hospitals now have financial counselors. Sometimes they're part of the social work service. Sometimes they're in the billing financial office. But they really are designed to help patients try to figure out a plan to pay off a particular bill that they might have. And sometimes they'll also help with sliding scale fees or even charity care in some cases, which we'll talk about a little bit more in a minute. Another thing that many people don't realize is that if they qualify for Badger Care, for Medicare, Medicaid, it's possible that Medicaid will pay bills that you incurred even before you were enrolled. So they have about a 3-month window where potentially, not guaranteed, but potentially, some expenses could be covered. So if, for example, someone with kids who clearly has low income, clearly because of having kids would qualify for Badger Care, ends up using the emergency room for health care for their kid, and then signs up the next week for Badger Care and qualifies and gets in, it is possible that they could submit those claims to Badger Care. It's not a program that a lot of people, it's not a feature of the program that a lot of people realize, but certainly can be one way to try to handle those expenses when the time comes. Now, obviously, the best thing to do would be to be enrolled in Badger Care before you need it, but it is possible to have some retroactive coverage on those kinds of things. The next option is charity care. And charity care and financial aid are really tough topics. It is very hard to find clear information about how to qualify for charity care or for financial aid from hospitals. They're not like universities where financial aid is sort of part of the package when you come in. It's oftentimes something you have to ask for and really hunt around to try to find information about. Many hospitals do have charity care programs where they provide sometimes free but most often lower cost or sliding scale services to lower income households that can show that they, through the tax returns or through other kinds of verification, that their income or wealth qualified. And those services are typically handled by the hospital counseling, to the extent they have financial counseling or social work functions. They're the ones that are sort of the gateway to those kinds of services. There is some information in the Wisconsin Department of Health website about charity care programs, but again, it's very hard to know because each hospital has its own processes and application process, and sometimes timelines, so that you may not know what's going to be covered by charity care. So the key there is just to ask. And so when, particularly say if a lower income family had needs for a child and they're talking to the hospital and talking to the provider about getting some care done, having some conversations with the hospital beforehand about what is possible, and continuing to push that after the expenses have been incurred are important too. Because that's sometimes this can be retroactively applied for a particular expense that might have been incurred. There are also some charity programs. They tend to be more disease specific though, so and not huge. I mean, I think these programs are wonderful. They serve lots of people, but the you know, the depth of the help for any one particular client oftentimes isn't that deep. But they're, you know, disease specific. So you know, we list some in the brief, the cancer care and leukemia and some other kinds of programs that are out there. There is a directory. This Patient Advocacy Foundation has a directory of organizations that help with medical debt. So it's basically a database of charities and of charitable arms of healthcare organizations that can be searched to try to find support. Next thing to talk about is actual debt. It is a growing problem that healthcare providers recognize that some portion of their clients aren't able to pay their bills in full. And so we've heard stories, I don't know how widespread it is, but we've certainly heard stories of healthcare providers offering you the ability to actually take out a loan at the healthcare provider site. Now, mostly this tends to happen in sort of elective surgeries or, you know, cases where they're where health insurance coverage would be pretty minimal. But there, you know, there are certainly providers who recognize that they want to get paid, and the easiest way to do that is to make sure that people have some credit option available at the medical care site. So they'll have a credit card that you can enroll in right there and then have your medical bills charged on that credit card. Now, when that happens, that credit card now becomes just like every other credit card you own, and you're on the hook as a creditor, with that creditor as a debtor. Unlike the, as I mentioned earlier, medical debt really has, it takes a while to become debt. It's a bill that doesn't get paid. This instantly becomes debt, real debt, at a rate of interest that's typical for credit cards, with all the fees and everything else associated by that. And oftentimes the, you know, the medical provider isn't around shopping around for the best deal. So the credit cards you sign up for at the healthcare provider's office probably aren't what you would prefer if you were to actually go around, shop on the market, and try to find a credit card to pay for these kinds of things. Certainly we see people taking out home equity loans or even reverse mortgages where they convert their home equity into income or cash to pay bills. Sometimes people will cash out their retirement accounts. These are all different ways to try to either borrow or convert assets into the ability to pay medical bills. These are not issues I would ever recommend talking about with a client. I mean, these are, once you're talking about taking on debt, taking out a reverse mortgage, borrowing against your retirement account, this is where having a real financial advisor or an attorney involved is critical, because you can't take back your 401k. You can't take back that home equity once you take that out. And like I said, once you open up a credit card, it becomes your credit card and it's your debt. So these are all really options that we would want to discourage people from taking without having a real clear plan and some real solid technical advice. Now, we've talked before on these calls about credit counseling. And so the NFCC is the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. And there is a online website that people can go to try to find information about credit counseling. Credit counselors are usually skilled at dealing with credit cards and mortgages and auto loans, sort of major credit card, consumer credit options. Some have experience with medical debt, but medical debt can be very esoteric and oftentimes very localized in terms of how a particular hospital or collector might deal with medical debt. And so national credit counseling call centers may or may not be that well versed in the medical debt issues of a particular client. Now, they can still be helpful in thinking about the overall credit issues and strategies, and, you know, in some cases, they may even have connections with some of the medical servicers, or they may even have a specialist counselor who can focus on the medical debt in their shop. So it's always NFCC member nonprofit agencies are always recommended as a place to get information. They're usually no cost and can help people at least figure out what the next steps might be, even if that particular counselor can't directly work with somebody on the medical debt that they might have. Finally, there is not for the growing field, but there is a field that exists of medical patient advocates. And so these advocates are fee-based private firms or individuals that will help you navigate the system. And, you know, particularly for people who are older, who have cognitive issues, you know, or for anybody who just finds, you know, waiting, you know, months and hours on the phone to try to get some of these issues resolved very frustrating. This can be a helpful service. It's oftentimes not inexpensive. I mean, I've seen fees of $100 or $200 an hour for some of the high-end advocates. But they can be helpful because they've been through these issues before, and, you know, sometimes a few hours might be enough to help somebody to try to take action. It's usually not an option for a low-income client, but for, you know, middle or higher-income client, this might be something that they want to pursue. Obviously, they have to shop around, get references, just like hiring any financial advisor or attorney, but sometimes that can be a helpful way to go. The last thing to talk about is bankruptcy. There is certainly a portion of bankruptcies. There is a portion of bankruptcies that are driven by somebody having a healthcare crisis. Now, the healthcare crisis oftentimes results in many different things going on, including not able to work and running up other debts and other kinds of bills, not being able to pay the mortgage. So all those things coalesce, and sometimes bankruptcy is the only way out. Medical debt can be discharged in bankruptcy, so it is possible that there are some ways to have some debt actually written off. The bankruptcy court's going to take into account the overall client situation, their income, their assets, what plan they're under, whether it's a 7 or 13. So it's hard to know exactly how it's going to come out. But for a client who's already exhausted repayment plans, maybe they have multiple judgments and deficiencies, talking to an attorney, a qualified attorney about bankruptcy might be one avenue to talk about, or one avenue to pursue. There's a number of links here to try to find more information about finding more about bankruptcy and finding an attorney to help through that process. So I'll stop there and just let people share any comments or feedback they have. I'll just let people know there's an additional page 6 with a number of different links, including a really nice program, a national project called the Access Project, where they talk about medical debt and how to deal with medical debt. And this is a nice resource. It's a nonprofit that has not only worked nationally, and much of the information in this brief is actually driven from some of their work. But there's a number of other links too, including the FTC and the healthcare.gov website and the Patient Advocate Foundation and some others. So I'll stop there, and the floor is open. Anyone have any experience in dealing with these issues, either personally or with clients, or other resources that they might want to share?
Some of the people, this is Ruth in Iowa County, some of the people that I see absolutely have medical debt on their credit reports. And I've seen huge amounts, but I've also seen, you know, things in the like $8,000 to $10,000 range where there's not even any resources to put toward that. So whether it's a little bit, you know, a few thousand versus lots and lots and lots of thousands, it's still frustrating for the client.
Yeah, I think the most common when I get these kinds of questions is that people are just overwhelmed by the scale of it. Particularly when it oftentimes comes in combination with the health crisis.
Yes.
Hi, and, this is Joanne. Oops, sorry.
Go ahead, Joanne.
You said like when a bill is 30 days, 60, whatever, sometimes the, like overdue, sometimes the EOB won't come for a couple, like 6 weeks. Do medical providers take that into account? Like if you want people to check their EOB, many times they can't until you know, the timing doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, it really varies by provider. You know, the process could take 6 months, and I think most healthcare providers are set up to be able to, you know, to ride out 6 months or more. But it certainly does happen.
Michael, I wasn't aware of the Wisconsin price point system, but is that ever fascinating? If you want to have an estimate of what something's going to cost before you go in, that's a really good place to check out. Thanks for sharing that one.
Yeah, it is somewhat alarming if you look at actually what some of the things cost, too. You realize if you do have health insurance, it really does help quite a bit. One of the challenges with trying to find the price of procedures is that there isn't usually there's a list price, and then there's the price that every insurer negotiates. And so, you know, I don't think most physicians even know what they cost, you know, for any particular procedure, because it's just not standardized across different insurance plans or different providers.
The other thing that can often happen is the facility might be, you know, preferred provider. The doctor might be, but the anesthesiologist isn't, or the, you know, other staff. So even if, I don't know about this particular site, but we've tried it with other sites and called in the facility and stuff, and it's really impossible. I mean, you still try to do it, but, you know, we've got bills because the nurse, I can never pronounce it, anesthesist, wasn't covered by my insurance.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty common problem where that, you know, even though you experienced one healthcare event, you had multiple providers, so for them it was, you know, four or five different claims that have to be processed, and they don't all get processed at the same time or the same way or at the same coverage level. So it seems to be a pretty common. People get, they see the first thing get covered, and they assume that everything else will be too.
I think what frustrates me so much just about the whole the billing practices is that I somewhat consider myself an informed consumer, somewhat educated, able to keep up on my bills and my correspondence and my communications. And I see so many of my clients that don't have those skills or don't have that as a priority, and how quickly they can become overwhelmed.
Yeah, I know. And speaking of providers, one of the things that you know, people who are, you know, maybe who have changed jobs quite a bit or are, you know, younger and just don't have as much experience with the system, they can come into provider and not actually know what coverage they have. I mean, not even know who their provider is, you know, who their coverage provider is. And so it's very hard for the provider to say, well, yes, I can bill that to insurance or I can't, because you don't really know what kind of coverage you have. And so it's, you know, it's one of those basic things that probably we take for granted, but there are probably some portion of the people that are in your classes or in your counseling sessions who really don't have a good sense of when they do need a healthcare bill paid for, who would they even go to? How would they manage that? Are there other resources that folks have come across that would be good to include in this? I'm not sure if that's good because we captured it all, or it's bad because there just aren't that many good resources out there.
Hi, Michael. This is Chris Kniep, and as I'm listening, I'm just thinking of how this is changing so much. So whatever you can provide is greatly appreciated, and because I know we'll use it.
That's good. I appreciate the support. And it is a tough topic. This is probably one of the hardest reason we try to get together, because it is changing, and it is such a broad set of technical skills that are involved.
I was at a public health meeting last week, or a meeting of health folks last week, and they were talking about how there's going to be a set amount of dollars on each procedure that they had a name for it. I'm sorry, an acronym, I should say, for it, that will be given to the continuum of care. If I were to, for example, if I were to have a heart attack, and that my health care provider would be given X number of dollars from the day I hit emergency room until I leave whatever follow-up care, that's all they're going to get. And as those, that information gets shared, how we need to know about that and work with people on it so they kind of get a sense of that big picture of healthcare now and how it's changing and services are going to change along with it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's one of the many moving parts of the changing structure of care.
And while that may take on a different consumer side of, you know, what quality care that goes along with it, it's also knowing how to manage those bills that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
So again, thank you.
Good, I appreciate it.
I have another question. Lots of us who are border counties, a lot of our clients go to Minnesota for care, or it might be Illinois or wherever else, and they're on Badger Care. I would assume that they have to follow the Badger Care rules, right, and policies in terms of billing and all of that.
It gets very complicated. So the providers actually have to be in the billing system for each state's plan.
Okay.
And from state to state, they generally use the same codes and generally pay the same. Well, no, they actually have different payment schedules. So it is complicated, but most providers are used to it. They deal with dozens of different insurance and other plans, so they can usually deal with it. It's probably more for the client to be aware of, you know, I'm coming with this particular plan, and they need to make sure that they know how to work with that plan. All right, well, I want to thank everybody for their time today. Just to let people know, the next call is on March 18th, and we're talking about behavioral economics, and specifically how you would apply that to your financial counseling and coaching and education programs. We have two more calls settled for this academic year, I guess, so one April 15th on financial capability using some new data that will be available. And then finally May 20th is our summer reading. So if you have any ideas for sort of popular press books on financial issues for families, send them to me, and we'll try to share, you know, half dozen or 10 or more different books that might be maybe not what you want to read by the pool, but at least something to spend some time looking at over the summer and to sort of brush up on financial education topics. So, thanks, everybody. Have a great week.